This is day 5 of this March 2014 7-day session. We'll return to the teachings of Muso Soseki, known as Muso Kokushi, National Teacher Muso, and this is from the book Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen, translated by Thomas Cleary. When you are ill, if you think you have to study medical science before getting treatment for your illness, you will get sicker and die before you ever finish learning medicine. If you go to an expert physician, however, the physician can diagnose your ailment and prescribe accordingly. As a patient, you may not understand the knowledge underlying the doctor's prescription, but if you follow expert advice, you will get well. Buddhist practice is also like this. If you try to learn all the doctrines first and then apply them, you might spend a whole lifetime studying the doctrines without learning them all. So many and diverse are they. If you never get around to application, learning is ultimately useless. Real teachers, therefore, give students only as much instruction as they need to apply. Even if the students cannot understand immediately, if they keep the directions of the teacher in mind without trying to fit them into preconceived interpretations, when the appropriate time arrives, the obscurity should dissolve. So this advice is based on trust in the teacher, of course, that you don't have to know why, the whys and the wherefores of her or his advice, but you just have faith that it's based on wisdom and experience. If that trust isn't there, well, it can develop over time. If the student discovers that the advice is good, but the key phrase here is keep the directions of the teacher in mind without trying to fit them into preconceived interpretations. So this is a big condition, because we all bring to Zen practice a whole freight car of our own notions and opinions about the way things are. That's a huge challenge for a teacher, is trying to have the student receive the teaching without mixing it up with other things. The what makes this so exceptionally difficult is that these preconceived interpretations mostly are unknown to the student herself. We're not aware of the way that we filter reality. You know, scientists are increasingly convinced that what any of us see of reality, what we call reality, is our interpretation of the data of our senses. It's our interpretation based on the template in our mind, the notions, the framework that we've set up over many, many years. And that framework or that filter is so part of us that we don't see it. We don't think it's just we're interpreting reality. We assume that we're seeing it as it is. Now, how how do you recognize each one of us, our particular filters when they're invisible to us. That's what is so difficult. Through practice, through long practice, we either little by little or in clumps, we start to notice these filters. And then, just to notice them, to see that we haven't been seeing things as they are, but we've been seeing things through these prisms, is liberating itself. When we plant a tree, as long as the roots take, the branches and leaves will naturally grow and the flowers and fruits will develop. Therefore, when we plant the tree, we are concerned about the roots and not about the branches and leaves. As long as the roots have not taken a firm hold, we prune off the small branches so that the energy will go to the roots. Remember here, this is Musso was a master of garden design, so he probably knows what he's talking about. That does not mean, however, that we plant the tree for the sake of the roots alone. We take great care with the roots for the sake of the branches, leaves, flowers, and fruits. Well, the roots would be the fundamental in Zen. The practice in its most essential sense. You could even say it's zazen, the actual sitting. You might consider the root. That's one way of understanding. Another is the root is the formlessness of form, the insight into the true nature of things. But just now, just staying on the level of the practical, if we consider sitting the root, then this this points to the emphasis in Zen on sitting, especially early in practice. I've been told that in Zen temples in Japan, that new monks are prohibited from reading. One way I've heard it is prohibited from reading the sutra, anything but the sutras. But still, just limiting it to the sutras, that's pruning away a lot of what the monk may have been exposed to before coming into the monastery. So he comes in, and the whole focus is on getting rooted in the practice, which really does mean cutting away. He says here, as long as the roots have not taken a firm hold, we prune off the small branches so the energy will go to the roots. So, for example, pruning off reading, certainly unnecessary reading, so that all of our energies, our entire focus, can go into the sitting, and what the sitting points to, which is that which is beyond form, beyond thought. And then he says, though it's not just for the sitting. If we use this kind of translation I'm offering, it's not just for the sitting. We do the sitting so that other things in our lives can flower and really come to fruition. So reading, for a monk, it would mean relationships, or someone in residential training, mean pruning away relationships at first would have value in terms of sitting and really concentrating on the essential, not being involved in politics, or even, if to put it very strictly, in monastic sense, not getting involved with cultural activities, not exposing oneself unnecessarily to all kinds of information on the web or other thing, but just to focus, get it all into the root, the sitting, use one's time to sit. This is the monastic way, as he outlines it here. And as it's, we know, traditionally, it has been in Zen practice. And then, in the normal course of things, after having seen into the essential, this would be a time when one could benefit by expanding one's horizons a bit, by then exposing oneself or getting involved in things more peripheral to the sitting, to the Zen practice in the strict sense, and to make all that one's practice, then to apply into political work, social work, reading, health issues, relationships, to then bring that insight that one has had through one's sitting, bring it in so it informs those things, those leaves and branches and flowers and fruits. Well, very few people really have this kind of focus. Even people in residential training who aren't monks officially, but who are in residential training. Of course, that's because if they're not monks, then they can spread themselves out into other things and that's their choice. But there is good sense to this traditional way. There's a logic to it of devoting all one's energy, putting all one's energy into the root before then extending that into the leaves and branches and so forth. Just a little bit more about that. It depends on your priorities. If you're truly determined to break through this ordinary consciousness and see into the nature of things, into your own nature, if that's a high priority, then you will quite easily be able to forego things that complicate your life. And you'll want to simplify it and keep it focused on the essential. That is, if you are in circumstances where you can do that, such as being on staff. But even not being on staff, people sometimes ask, householders ask, I'm going to Sesshin in 3 weeks, any advice about how I can really get ready for it? And what I usually say is anything you can do to simplify your life, your daily life, which means if you can prune away exposure to the stuff that can clog up the mind. Do spend less time surfing the web. Spend less time doing unnecessary reading, not related to your work. Simplify. Simplify. And of course, do extra sitting if you can. In Sesshin, which is a week of monastic practice, we don't have to worry about any of this because there is no reading. There is no of these other things. It's all the root. Skipping some of these entries here. Here it's the translator gives this little segment the title, Worldly Feelings. Attraction and aversion are two feelings that keep people within the bondage of ignorant, repetitive behavior. Ignorant, repetitive behavior. Don't we know that from facing the wall for hours a day? Those who seek only what pleases them and try to avoid what displeases them are acting in this way because they do not realize the nature of the world. For those who know the nature of the world, lack of complete satisfaction or fulfillment in things of the world is in itself advice to cultivate detachment. Lack of complete satisfaction or fulfillment in things of the world, relationships, job, dissatisfaction with these things is in itself advice to cultivate detachment from these worldly pursuits. If people do not crave to be pleased, they will not be displeased. What causes mental suffering is not the environment, but the mind itself. So he's just reminding us of one of the most basic of all Buddhist teachings, teachings of the Buddha, is that so long as we are devoting ourselves to avoiding what we don't want and grasping for what we want, we are doomed to suffer. We are bound to suffering. It's so basic. Most people in the world would say, "Puh, what do you mean? Of course I want to just maximize my likes, my preferences, and avoid things that are not pleasant." Yeah, and we have the freedom to do that, but we pay a price in the long run because we get attached to our wanting to avoid, and this is the bind we consign ourselves to when we make this a big pursuit of our lives. You see why Buddhism in the end is really a radical teaching. And I mean Zen too, is consciously with voluntarily trying to get beyond conditions, attachment to conditions, beyond our desires and aversions. But the rewards, the ultimate rewards of doing this are beyond anything that we can derive from whatever pleasures we manage to get to our for ourselves. It's a package deal. If we want to focus on pursuing what is pleasant, then we have to accept that we will suffer what is unpleasant. And that's what he what he means here. If people do not crave to be pleased, they will not be displeased. Once again, I'm preaching to the choir, but maybe this fundamental kind of truth is something that all of us can't hear too often. It is not necessary to get rid of worldly feelings in order to work on the fundamental. The fundamental, again, is the root. It's not necessary to get rid of worldly feelings. Those who are keenly aware of the precariousness of our situation as human beings and the brevity of our opportunity to awaken, and who use this awareness to hone their will, are not distracted from the work by worldly feelings. So here, what does he mean by worldly feelings? I had to just give this a little thought. Let's interpret it this way: worldly as compared to spiritual. So, I mean, feelings are feelings. Whether it doesn't matter whether you're sitting or a monk or a householder. Human beings all have basically the same feelings. So when he says worldly feelings, I'm guessing that he means feelings related to family and work, one's job, one's occupation, and to finances, let's say. These are things that monks, true monks, would have far fewer of. So feelings, concerns about one's children, hopes for one's children, concerns about one's parents, issues with your co-workers at your job. Of course, that comes up in any residential training as well. But financial, that's something that would be distinguished from monastic feelings. I say it would be financial concerns, that we don't need to get rid of these in order to work on the fundamental. Any more than we need to get rid of thoughts. It's not getting rid of feelings or emotions or thoughts. It's just not dwelling in them. So in Sesshin, of course, feelings come up, worldly feelings, any kind of feelings come up as we're sitting. We don't have to get rid of them. Really, we don't. We don't have to dispel them. We just have to just rivet on the practice that we're working on. And then those feelings, whatever we call them, worldly or otherworldly, those feelings and those thoughts and concerns recede. They aren't a problem. They may still be flitting around in the periphery of the mind, but they're not impinging on us if we just continually return our attention to the practice and the practice alone. Those things just drift away on their own. We don't have to expel them. They just become less of an issue. And then he goes on, feelings that arise because of circumstances can actually be used to fuel the urgency of work toward the fundamental. Preliminary methods of softening worldly feelings are taught for the sake of those with insufficient determination. This does not mean that work on the fundamental is to be undertaken only after worldly feelings are ended. So this methods, preliminary methods of softening worldly feelings. So somewhere here he mentions the method here it is. Yeah, I'll just skip over here for a minute and then go back. There is a popular practice commonly found in Buddhist sutras and Zen writings that consists of looking upon all phenomena as if they were dreams or illusions. This practice is in the realm of method and is not an ultimate teaching. Secular literature and folk sayings use the image of things being like dreams or phantasms to mean that everything is transient. In Buddhism, the implication is that phenomena are ultimately insubstantial, but nevertheless conditionally manifest. This represents a balance, avoiding both reification and nihilism. So, all right, we're getting a little bit off here. Let's just for a moment stick to this this method of seeing, looking upon all phenomena as if they were dreams or illusions. I haven't heard of that as a Zen practice. It sounds like it's used in other kinds of Buddhist practice, but I've never heard of it in Zen. But that would be an example of what he means here when he says, preliminary, refers to preliminary methods of softening worldly feelings. So, to go back to our examples, issues with one's children, one's parents, finances, to see these things as if they're dreams is a kind of softening of what that would soften them to the extent that we would be able to do that, our concerns about them would be softened, and we would be able, he's saying, to focus more on the fundamental. But it's I think the reason I would assume that it's not a particularly Zen practice is that it's adding something. This trying to see, look upon things as if in a dream. It's trying to create an effect. And that's what is unique, I think, about Zen, is we're not trying to create an effect. So, for example, with metta meditation, loving-kindness meditation, there too there's a bringing forth or creating this effect of loving-kindness toward all kinds of people, which is certainly a valid practice, a legitimate practice, a valuable practice, but it's not Zen because it's adding something, trying to be loving kind. And this would be, I think, the same thing. Looking upon things as a dreamer. It's, you know, those theater lights where you can slide in these plates, filters. You can put in a yellow filter, put in a blue filter, a red filter that casts different kinds of lights. Well, this is how I see these practices. They're methods that can be useful, but they're not really orthodox Zen, which is just taking away all the filters. Just seeing things, stripping things bare and seeing things as they are. But as he says, if our practice on the fundamental, let's say the koan, working on mu, if we keep getting sidetracked by these feelings, worldly concerns, then that can be a way to keep the mind on the target. Another method that some of us can vouch for is psychotherapy. It's a contemporary, native method of softening worldly feelings by working with a therapist and examining, investigating what gives rise to these obstructive emotional attachments and reactions to people and situations. This can also soften worldly feelings and sort of help us get free of the grip of some of these things. He continues, even while you call to mind ways of softening worldly feelings when they arise, still you should not give up work on the fundamental. So we don't have to choose between the two. Even as we're employing some method, like psychotherapy or looking upon things as in a dream, from time to time, then we still maintain our practice where we keep returning the mind to this realm of no thought, no form. We'll find in the case of psychotherapy that our work with the therapist will generate thoughts that will invade our zazen. And that's sort of the trade-off. I see psychotherapy as an investment. You're investing. You're accepting that your zazen is going to be cluttered somewhat by all the stuff, the dust that's being kicked up through your work in psychotherapy, but only in the short term, and for the long term, it can help get more deeply engaged with one's practice to the extent that it may knock out the wedges, the emotional attachments that get in the way of zazen. Still, you should not give up work on the fundamental. It is said that people with intense determination for enlightenment neglect even to eat and sleep. Such people do become tired and do become hungry, but they rest and eat in the midst of the work and therefore are not hindered even when sleeping or eating. So you make the resting, you make the eating practice. You don't drop the koan. If people who lack such determination go without eating or sleeping, they will become ill. This will hinder their practice, so they are encouraged to eat enough to overcome hunger and sleep enough to overcome fatigue. This does not mean, however, that they should forget the work while eating or sleeping. An ancient Zen master gives this advice. When you walk, watch the walking. When you sit, watch the sitting. When you recline, watch the reclining. When you see and hear, watch the seeing and hearing. When you notice and cognize, watch the noticing and cognizing, or thinking. When joyful, watch the joy. When angry, watch the anger. Working in this way will lead to awakening. So in other words, bring mindfulness to everything you do. Bring awareness. Know what's going on in your mind. Awareness is one way to understand the word Buddha. Usually the word Buddha is defined as awakening or the awakened one. But very, very close second to that is awareness. When we're aware, we're awake in a certain way. Now, back to this, this sort of paradox that he mentioned. I'll just read the first, I'll read the sentence again. Secular literature and folk sayings use the image of things being like dreams to mean that everything is transient. In Buddhism, the implication is that phenomena are ultimately insubstantial, that is, in the absolute sense, they're insubstantial, but nevertheless conditionally manifest. So in Buddhism, to say that things are just a dream, things are just an illusion, is only correct to a point. It's only half the truth. So to say that that car speeding toward me is just an illusion is half true. It is. It's I obviously don't have to finish this. The car is made up stuff, molecules and subatomic particles and all that are in flux, and to that extent it is illusory. It's just it's basically empty of any self-substance. So in that sense we can say it's illusory. But then there's the other side of it. My favorite example of this dual nature of phenomena is the hologram. I think this is a perfect analogy of the way things are, that a hologram is just an image created from laser beams, light in a certain way. You can put your hand right through it, so it's illusory in that sense. But there it is. It's a thing we can talk about. This is really how I understand no self. It is said that people who are truly on the way do not discuss judgments of others. This does not mean that they make judgments but suppress them. It means they do not see people in terms of self and other. The third patriarch of Zen said, "In the realm of being as is, there is no other and no self." This is from the Affirming Faith and Mind, a line from the Affirming Faith and Mind with a little different translation. In the realm of being as is, there is no other and no self. A sutra says, the nature of reality is like an ocean. You should not say there is right or wrong. He continues, if people view the world in terms of distinctions between others and self, they will inevitably make judgments of right and wrong. If they entertain views of right and wrong, they are not true practitioners of the way, even if they refrain from expressing their views. So this is one of the most common things to run into, especially for beginners. Beginners will often say how painful it is to see how kind of reflexively they judge other people. and they realize have always done so without noticing it. And then you get into practice and you start noticing the way the mind works, and you start seeing how habitually we judge other people and ourselves. That's the next step, is when we see how we judge ourselves. They always go together. You're not going to be judging other people and not judging yourself. And you're not going to be judging yourself and not judging other people. In our true mind, there's no distinction of self and other. And whatever we're doing to ourselves, we're going to be doing to other people at some level. He says, rather than try to refrain from discussing judgments of others, therefore, students of Buddhism should turn around and reflect, who is it that speaks of others right and wrong? Or, who is it that thinks of others right and wrong? This is the work of people who are working on the inquiry, who am I? Or what? What am I? What is this? Who? What is judging others? Who is judging others? He continues, even those who have set aside all judgments of right and wrong and do not view people in terms of self and other cannot be said to be truly on the way as long as they have not seen the original state before personal history. It's an interesting translation here that Cleary makes, before personal history. Before our parents gave birth to us. What is the original state before our parents gave birth to us? This is a koan in at least in Japan. Who am I before I was born? Who am I before I was a man or a woman? He continues, a way to see this original state is to turn the attention inward. What is it that distinguishes and defines self and other, body and mind? What is it that thinks of right and wrong and gain and loss? In ancient times, Nan Yue went to the sixth patriarch of Zen. Seeing him approach, the patriarch asked, what is it that has come in this way? It's another koan, fundamental koan. What is it? What is it that has come in this way? Unable to answer, Nan Yue withdrew. After 8 years of inner reflection, he finally had a great realization. So he took this question of the sixth patriarch bit into him so deeply that he couldn't shake it. He worked on it for 8 years and had a great realization. And then the answer he came back with is kind of anticlimactic, but I'll read it. Returning to the patriarch, Nan Yue replied, it would not be accurate to refer to it as something. This is really a profound understanding. Would not be accurate to refer to it as something. Well, because that would only be half the truth. If we say anything about the self, it's only half the truth. If we say the self is nothing, that's only half the truth. Only then did Nan Yue receive the approval of the Zen patriarch. It may seem that Nan Yue's inability to understand and answer immediately shows that he was dull. In actuality, however, the fact that he pursued the question, what is it that has come, to the very end, and ultimately came back with the answer, is evidence of his sharpness. Without this penetrating inquiry, you can never become enlightened. So it seems so self-evident. You can't argue with success that we can't fault him for having taken 8 years working on this question if it led to his awakening. The fact that he couldn't come up with an answer right away is beside the point. The real wonderful thing about this story is that it bit into him like that, and he took it so seriously and found a way to work with it and go to the bottom with it. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.